What's good, y'all? This is Breeze Brewing from the Mighty Juggernauts. And make sure you subscribe and download the podcast, Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel, hip-hop journalism on the highest level.
Yeah, well, what's up? It's your boy, Joel Ortiz, and I want everybody to make sure that they subscribe and download the podcast, Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. Yo, Tim, I hope all is well. You my guy. I know these interviews are not interviews. They're actually conversations, and I appreciate them all. Yeah, well.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ice-T. I want you to do something for me. Make sure you download and subscribe Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. It is official, all right? Stop playing. Download and subscribe. Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Einenkel. It's cold.
Empire State Rap, yeah. New York City. Brooklyn, the Bronx, Queens, Manhattan, Staten Island, Long Island. Yeah, yeah. From the start, though, darker than the episode of Narcos. Be smart, don't follow the rapper like Donnie Darko. It's Brooklyn. My niggas rock more Polo than Marco. We keep a Queens lace, more shoes than the Mel DeMarcos. We keep a mean face like you don't want no problems. Too many rap niggas be talking to the five. They're leaking more secrets than Trump at the Mar-a-Lago. We on cold like Fred Hampton out of Chicago. Free the land, free the man.
Diamond D has impacted our lives for over 30 years, starting before his debut album Stunts, Blunts, and Hip Hop, to working with artists such as A Tribe Called Quest, The Fugees, Bumpy Knuckles, Pharrell Monch, Fat Joe, KRS-One, and many more. The DITC legend is a musical genius and has just released a new album with Talib Kweli, Gotham. With that, Diamond D, welcome to Library Rap, the Hip Hop Interviews with Tim Einenkel. Thank you so much for being here. Such an honor.
Yeah, man, I'm glad to be here. You know, I'm glad to be here.
So, thank you. Of course, I want to talk about this new album that you and Kweli just dropped. But before we get into that, when anybody, you know, you talk to anybody about what does the name Diamond D mean? And they think of, you know, obviously a legendary producer, an MC. But reading up on you, it seems like your passion wasn't always producing or MCing. It was DJing. So what kind of drew you to being a DJ? And then when did you decide to make that switch over to producing and MCing?
You know, Tim, most producers, about 95% of us start out as DJs. You know, whether it's Timbaland or Dr. Dre or any other producer. But most producers start off as DJs. Just the concept of blending records and timing and things of that nature. When I made my transition, around the time of Lord Finesse, when I was co-producing Lord Finesse's first album with Premier and Showbiz, the Funky Technician. That's another time where I kind of made the transition. I was a DJ in the group Ultimate Force. We put up that single on Strong City Records called I'm Not Playing. And then, like I said, around 1990 is when I made the transition.
Yeah, D, you just talked about Ultimate Force and having the single on Strong City Records, I'm Not Playing. It was one release, you know, one 12-inch single release. Why, and that was back in 1989, but why only one release? And was there an entire album ready to go with that? Or was it just kind of that was the plan with it?
You know, around that time, Strong City lost their distribution deal with Universal, I believe. So the album was shelved, but it was released in 2007. So it finally did see the light of day. It's just unfortunate that it took about 14 years for that to happen. But it was released.
If it was released in a timely manner, do you see? I mean, did you already have a goal in mind for your career trajectory, or do you think we would be having a totally different conversation today?
Well, you know what? Even at that time, I was dabbling in exploring my own thing. Like I said, I was just a DJ in that group, and I was also the producer. During the course of making that album, or maybe shortly after, I recorded The Best Kept Secret. And that's the single that actually got me signed on that that Chemistry Records. And that led to my Stunt Bloods and Hip Hop album. That was the first demo, Best Kept Secret.
When did you start focusing on that kind of your own thing, the Best Kept Secret, and then ultimately going into your debut album?
About 1991. I got the deal in 91. Before I even got signed, there were like certain records I would set aside and say, you know, if I ever get my own situation, I'm gonna sample this. So I had like a whole half a crate of records that I wanted to use if something ever came together that was just a Diamond D project and not an Ultimate Force project. The Ultimate Force album was already done.
Mm-hmm.
So what's crazy is just how everything panned out. When the Best Kept Secret came out, a lot of people who knew me in the South Bronx, around the Farmers Project area, they were surprised. They were like, yo, what are you doing on a microphone? Like, they all knew me from, like, you know, spinning records.
Right.
So, yeah, it was just wild, Tim. It was wild, just looking back at it now. But, you know, I'm grateful for that experience.
Was there pushback obviously the besides the intro, the first track on Stunts, Blunts, and Hip Hop is the Best Kept Secret, right? Which is obviously you spitting on that track. Was there pushback from the, I guess, the MC community about you rhyming on a track, being like, well, you're a producer, shouldn't you kind of stay in your own lane type thing?
No, because even in the press releases for that album, I made it known that I'm a producer first.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, MCs who lived and died by MCing didn't see it as a threat. They saw it as just a producer who's rhyming on his songs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And even today, if somebody asks me, what's my first love? I would say producing. DJing and then rhyming in that order. It just so happens that I rhyme better than a lot of MCs. So I'm aware of that too.
Nice, that's dope. I want to ask you about Big L, because the sense of, like, you know, we always talk about B-sides, right? And B-sides winning, you know, and P says B-sides wins again. And you have Ice-T 6 in the Morning, which is a B-side. You have UTFO's Roxanne, which is a B-side. And then you have another B-side, but it's on Lord Finesse's debut album, which is introducing an artist, and that artist is Big L.
Right.
Do you remember the first time you met Big L, and what, if anything, stood out to you as an artist, or did anything actually stand out to him? And were you impressed by him at first, or did that kind of take a while to warm up to?
Well, at this time, Lord Finesse is on fire. So anybody he was co-signing had to be crazy. When I first heard L, I said what a lot of people said around that time. And that was that he sounded like Lord Finesse, but maybe newer. If I can use that word,
mm-hmm.
You know, but even Big L said that Lord Finesse was one of his favorite MCs, just the whole punchline style
mm-hmm.
that Lord Finesse had kind of mastered when he made Funky Technician and The Return of the Funky Man.
In 1994, the Fugees released their debut album, Blunted on Reality, right? And at that time, it sold only 12,000 copies. In 96, they released their second album, The Score, which I think was what a lot of people were finally introduced to them, right? It sold 22 million copies. It was obviously a highly, highly appreciative album. Proz has talked about how during the process, you talked to them about how you wanted to get on the album and produce a song with them, and that ultimately became The Score.
Wyclef approached me in the tunnel, the underground club in New York City. He approached me. Why would I approach the Fugees coming off of a flop, Tim?
That was my question. Yes, exactly.
Right. Stupid. But you know, motherfuckers want to embellish and all that. Whatever.
So I guess what was the Wyclef pitch that said to you, you know, hey, we just did a flop. Can you produce this?
No. When I met him, they had that joint out, Mona Lisa. You know.
Yeah.
The Salaam Remy remix. And a lot of people was feeling that, including me. Mm-hmm. That's how I even knew who Wyclef was. So naturally, me being into that song, when he approached me and said he wanted to hear some beats, I said, okay, give me a week. A week later, I met him at the 45 Kings house. Him and Praz came, and that's when I played the beats for them. And one of those beats became the score.
Soldiers, left, right, left, right.
It's time I settle the score.
Left, right, left, right, left, left.
It's time I
left,
settle the score. Left.
Ripple to the rum, rum to the ripple, single. But the times I come in triple.
I mean, even though they had this flop, did you? As a producer, did you automatically kind of try to dismiss those numbers and saw the potential in all of them?
Well, back then, I didn't know how many records they sold. I had never heard of them. But like I said, that remix that Salaam Remy did kind of saved them. That's the only reason, in hindsight, Columbia gave them another chance. Columbia Rough House, I believe they were on Rough House. But like I said, the remix, it made some traction.
Right.
And that's what saved them. Typically, if you only sell about 12,000 units, a major label would not invest in you anymore.
Nah, it doesn't make sense.
They also had good management back then.
I want to ask you about a DMX, because I think when he passed away, you wrote something on IG that kind of stands up, and it's a reason why I've always liked DMX as an artist. For many reasons, but I think he made us in a way kind of face our like contradictions in a way of like we believe something and then he says something and it kind of like forces us to be like, that's a dope lyric and that makes sense and that's not what I thought about, but you talked about how he had his personal struggle with righteousness, but the dark side is the thing that brought him fame, and he kept on kind of struggling with that.
Yeah, that was a repost from my good friend Bones Malone. But I know what you're talking about.
But it says something a lot about how I think a lot of DMX fans felt about him, is that he did kind of, he was this person who dealt with a daily struggle of, you know, had to contradict his life in terms of trying to be this good man, but then, you know, had a dark side to which brought him fame.
You know, it's almost like Marvin Gaye.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. How hard is it? You know, you've done this for obviously a while. How hard is it for an artist to change his or her image, especially when that first image that we know about them has gained acceptance and is relevant to the public versus the one he or she wants to be?
No, I mean, that's subjective and it varies from artist to artist. You're talking about DMX. I don't know, from the outside looking in, because I didn't know X like that. You know, I met him a few times in passing, but I didn't know the brother. But, you know, I know he went to rehab a few times. So possibly if he would have just left whatever he was doing alone and just focused on the other stuff that got him where he was at, perhaps things would have worked out differently. But you know, addiction is real.
Yes.
You got food addiction too. You got gamblers. I know motherfuckers who, like, I know people right now, if they was in this room with me, they'd be betting $100 bills on who can toss the dime the closest to the wall. Like, you know, gambling addiction is real too. But yeah, rest in peace, the great DMX.
I want to ask you about Buck Wild, who was interviewed on the podcast, and you know, I told him I was interviewing you, and he sent, you know, he wrote back and said, you know, he gives you so much respect because you gave him his first remix track, which was Shit Is Real. What stood out to you? Buck Wild as a producer? What stood out to you as him being a producer?
What stood out to me was, it's like he just popped, like he was he was a DJ. Like most producers, he was a DJ. And then he just popped up making beats, and the beats, you know, the beats was tight. And I don't know who he asked to show him. Like, he just popped out of nowhere and shit was like, well, you know, around that time, he was around Lord Finesse a lot, too. He was around Lord Finesse, and a lot of Buck Wild's earlier beats sounded like Finesse beats at that time, respectfully. Yo, it's crazy, Tim. It's like, I don't know. It's like Buck got his hands on an SB-12 or whatever he was using, and like in a matter of months, he had got to the point where he was ready to like start shopping beats.
I mean, what's great about this podcast and talking to, you know, artists like yourself and also Buck Wild is that your mind works in this incredible way that only I wish my mind could work. You know, in terms of this, like hearing a beat and knowing, or hearing a sample and knowing perfectly where all the pieces are going to fit, and kind of and knowing full well like when a creating a beat and knowing that it's not the beat that people are looking for, but knowing that it's going to be a hit. And one beat that really stands out, and Buck Wild talks about this, is the beat for Whoa. With Black Rob, where he said at that time nobody was looking for kind of slow beats, but he kind of knew this was going to be something. Do you remember him playing you that beat, and were you kind of part of the camp that was too slow, or did you like, what did you think about the beat at the time?
I never heard that beat.
Oh, wow.
Until Whoa came out.
And I guess with Rob's voice, I mean, what is Rob's voice kind of helps elevate that beat, and you know the beat was already elevated enough, but that beat. What was the first time you heard
his voice, his flow on the track, and the shit that he was saying? Everything connected to a lot of people outside of New York. Whoa was like a new slang word, you know. And then, you know, then you got the Bad Boy Machine that was behind him. Everything was just aligned for Rob for that record.
Rob does it in incredible track with you off of the dime piece, the Take Him Off the Map, and on it in the chorus he spits, "Everybody tell me to dumb down, then screw all, I guess I raise the bar." Can you talk about the state of hip hop, and they say of New York hip hop in particular, when Black Rob debuted in 2000, and kind of how did his album Life Story and how did himself kind of raise that bar that, you know, that he talks about in the song with you?
Rob was the hometown favorite, the underdog. I remember at that time, Puff was on the shiny suits.
Right.
And then here comes, you know, Black Rob, who's also on Bad Boy, but like the anti-Bad Boy. I think I might have saw Rob in a suit one time. Rob was like, he was on Bad Boy, but, you know, he was like, you know, had his own movement, anti shiny suits, gutter. The storytelling was crazy. His delivery, his voice. You know, Rob was one of the best that ever did it.
When he debuted, did he remind you of anyone that you worked with previously, or kind of?
Nope. Nah. He had his own style. Black Rob ain't sound like nobody.
Think I'm the head honcho. Won't do bongo like Polanco. Money sold like an obelisk. Scratch that, my life on wax. I'm a novelist. Are you sure I'm the one you want problem with? Range Rover convertible truck, something I gotta get. You telling me this not the shit? Messing with my Al Green, I'ma get the grits. All these newcomers leave without a pot to piss, and that's nothing, fam. It's worse on a stop and frisk. Real man.
Yeah. I want to ask you one more thing about the dime piece, and it's this, the first track off of it with Rap Life featuring Pharaoh Monch. There's these incredible horns that are being played on the track, and the great thing about these horns is that one, they fit perfectly with Pharaoh Monch, but two, you used them in a way where you knew they weren't going to drown out or distract the listener from any of Monch's lyrics. How'd you know to do that? Like, I mean, just kind of take me into the process for you and how you know, produced this song, but then knew this would be the kind of the perfect fit, I think, for Pharaoh.
Well, I didn't know it would be a perfect fit for Pharaoh, but I played him the beat and he loved it. I didn't make that beat for Pharaoh. That was just the track that I had. As far as the horns that I sample are in the same key as the other stuff that I sample. And then, you know, in the mixing process, that's where your engineer can layer it to a point where all the elements of the song doesn't drown out the MC. So that's basically what happened.
Deals when the nigga can actually rap right. It's a mirror to motherfuckers who ain't rap right.
I say Ricky Ticky Timbo, no Sal Rimbo, Chari Ariucci, Pit Perry Pimbo. Spikes on my mic device, slice like Kimbo. Toxic when
it's turned to the new album. You've collaborated with Quali in the past on you know the Dime Piece 1 and 2, and then you've also, but we go back further on Pharaoh's Internal Affairs album, where you produced The Truth with Common and Quali. When did you kind of know, I guess, that there was some sort of, you know, there was a great chemistry between you two, that an album was possible to have, not just a single here, a single there?
Like you said, you know, me and Tyler, we go back to the Internal Affairs album. So, you know, we always respected each other, artistry. You know, I always thought he was dope MC. You know, he always said, you know, he loved my beats. It really wasn't planned. Mm-hmm. Shit didn't happen. I sent him about 9 beats. He said, I'm working on an album. Well, I would like to work on an album. I want to hear some beats. So I was scheduled to fly to LA and do his show, People's Party. So I sent him like around 9 beats. And I don't know, maybe about 3 or 4 days later when I got there, I said, yo, which beat did you like? You know, singular, which beat did you like? He was like, beat? I brought the all of them shit. So, that's how it came together, Tim. And some songs didn't make the final cut, but that's the premise of how Gotham came to be. And all these journalists be clout chasing the Quali was living out in LA for a while. He said that my beat just reminded him of an East Coast flavor. Which they are. So I guess it was just the mind state. But like I said, my first thing I said to him was, which beat did you want? So I had no idea that he had felt all of them to the point where, in the span of 2 days, he recorded 9 joints.
Is that process for you? Is that normal? You know, I mean, was that a surprise? I guess more in terms of like how you normally are able to work with an artist. Be like, all right, I'll send you a few beats. You pick one. I mean, or do you get those artists that are? I mean, their pen games are just so nice that the beats are perfect for them and they could just, you know, fill out 9 beats.
A little bit of both. But like I said, with Talib, you know, I did say which beat was you feeling. You know, it's hard. It's hard, Tim. Every artist is different. You know, I've sent beats to some artists and they say, well, you know, can we hear something else?
The track On Mamas is a track celebrating the greatness of New York City, and it kind of is the type of track that reminds me of Jean Grey's Block Party, where she talks about kind of getting off the block but traveling the world and then learning from it and coming back and talking about that. Can you talk about the importance of a track for you at this time of On Mamas, and what have you learned about hip hop culture from around the world that you, when you come back home, you bring to the table?
What I learned about hip hop culture is when you go overseas, a lot of fans still want to hear classic hip hop. That's from my observation. But, you know, at the same time, you know, the new shit is popping off right over there, too. That's not to say the new shit ain't clicking over there. The new shit is clicking hard overseas, but there's still an admiration and respect for classic hip-hop. Artists from the 90s or 2000s. More so than back here in the States. So, you know, you ask any artist that and they'll tell you. Spray paint, I ain't getting up to get fame. Now a baby's coming out of the womb, like gang gang. Back in the day, all of that banging was a Cali thing. You could tell the difference from the New York and the Cali slang. I love to write to the clanging of the train. The kids playing on the swing, the brap of the gun, play the air horn. To tell the acidics it's time to pray. The drumming on Sundays in the park where the sun rays shine down on the hollow grounds where rap started at. My bar.
What's the importance of a track like Ah Mama's for you, which kind of, you know, celebrates New York City?
Yeah, All Mamas was just, you know, a celebration of New York City. I think All Mamas was, that wasn't the first track he recorded. That might have been the fourth. I just did a remix for it, too. I'm about to release the remix to that.
Many things that you're known for are remixing tracks, right? And those remixes are, you know, are sometimes more appreciated, or, you know, get more fanfare than the original. Do you have other remixes planned for this album, and why, what's the thinking behind when you decide to do a remix for a track?
Is the remix better than the original? That's the main goal, or just different enough? Whether sonically or with new rhymes. There are no rules. I approach each one differently. But for the On Mama's remix, what I did was I changed the drums up. So now, instead of sounding like an electro track, it has a deep funk hip hop feel now with the remix I just did.
You know, we're obviously talking during, you know, it's been a pandemic year. So was the album created during this year, or was it, I guess, when did the studio sessions happen, or the final, you know, the mixing?
I would say we started maybe fall 2019, and we went to like spring 20. So yeah, from fall 2019 to spring 20.
We talked about kind of contradictions with DMX, and I want to ask you about the track Chillin' While Black. And I want to ask you about this because it's an interesting exercise for me in terms of like the lyrical content being, you know, in an interesting way contradicted, not in a bad way, by the beat that's supporting it. Because the lyrics are about police killing blacks for just being black, right? But the beat to me is kind of very celebratory in a way. Was that purposeful when you guys put the tracks together? Yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, not like 4th of July celebratory, but, you know, more, I guess, more upbeat than I would think for a track that's about kind of a very somber topic.
Right. You know what? I kind of see the reasoning behind that statement. But at the same time, it's a soulful beat, and the horns just grab your attention. It reminded me, I was in the mind state of Chuck D and Public Enemy, where they have these beats, as you know, these backbone beats, but then the horns will pull you in. And kind of make you listen to what the MC is saying.
Right. Like, kind of like a harder than you think type thing.
I'm thinking more like Don't Believe the Hype, Rebel Without a Cause. Rebel Without a Cause. Those records.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, you know, it just sounded like nothing you heard. Like, the beat was funky, but then you had them crazy horns in. That's kind of like how I look at it. It's a good contrast, because you just said how the beat sounds celebratory, But at the same time, the shit that we talking about is some real shit.
Right, and you're right, and you're totally right in a way that it does make you. I think that's one of the. I mean, all the tracks you focus on the lyrics as well, but this is like that's that time where you really focus on the lyrics, maybe because you're like, well, they're not talking about celebratory shit, and they're at the same time like, oh, what is he saying? And you're right, it does work out perfectly in terms of what you guys are trying to accomplish with, especially with that track.
Might get arrested just for chilling while black.
There's a war going on outside, no black is safe from. The daily bullshit we can't escape from. Salutary thoughts take shape from. Behind the eyes, I've seen DA's lies. Trumped up alibis, drowned by mama's cries. They hate us all, it ain't hard to surmise. Spirit of Newton.
You know, the album Gotham starts with Sons of Gotham and then leaves us with The Fold. Can you just talk about the reasoning behind, like, kind of bookending the album with these two tracks?
Well, Sons of Gotham, I felt, would set the tone of the album. So that's why that's the first track. The Fold, it really wasn't too much thinking into it. The Fold was like the last song we recorded.
Nice.
So, you know, it just ended on that. And I was rhyming on it too, so we just said, fuck it, we're gonna leave it like that. It wasn't no huge thought process for that particular song in respect to the sequence.
You know, you look at the features on the album, you obviously have, you know, that you and Quali, you know, asked to be on the album. You have Busta, you have Sky Zoo, you know, John Forte, Nico Is, Nairi All Day. As a producer and even as an MC, can you talk about briefly about, you know, each of these artists and what stands out to you that, you know, makes them, as a producer, saying, I want, you know, a Sky Zoo, I want Busta to be on this track?
Well, Quali picked all of the guests. The guest that I picked was Afro.
Oh, nice.
And Afro, he rhymed on the song. As far as Busta Rhymes, of course, Busta Rhymes is legendary. You know, one of the best to ever do it. John Forte and Quali, they were in a rap group together in the early 90s. So they have history together. Sky Zoo, of course, one of the best of the new class to come out of Brooklyn. Did I cover everybody?
All Day?
Oh, Nairi All Day, yeah, okay. She's, again, Talib picked her. And when I got to the studio and heard what she had done, I was blown away. And then I went to check out her stuff. And her stuff is crazy.
You know, you've done this for, you know, a little over 30 years. What is kind of... has been that one constant, absolute favorite part of what you do, you know, that has stayed with you since you started and up until now?
Making something out of nothing. You know, just making something, I don't know, like making something out of nothing. That, like, that's what keeps me driven as far as a producer. You know, just to sit around a bunch of old records or whatever. And, sample, manipulate, create something that only you can do. That's the thing about, you know, you can give a producer, a room full of producers, the same record to sample, but everybody's going to have their own interpretation of it. That's one of the things that keeps me driven, and plus I'm still a fan of the music.
He's the great Diamond D, a new album with Talib Kweli Gotham. Diamond D, it's been an honor to have you on Library Rap, the Hip Hop Interviews with Tim Monaco. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ice-T. I want you to do something for me. Make sure you download and subscribe Library Rap, the Hip Hop Interviews with Tim Ioncal. It is official. Alright, stop playing. Download and subscribe Library Rap, the hip hop interviews with Tim Ironcow. It's Cold Cat.
We pro justice and we pro black. We pro black. We pro knowledge and we pro facts. No cap, we get it going like a soul clap. Well, most rap cats are terrified of the blowback.